Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for joining in our virtual meetings at a time of pandemic, and it's great to have David Coleman. He makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Now, before I introduce him, I should say this is an on-the-record discussion. The Minister's going to speak for a bit under half an hour, and then we'll do questions and discussion, and you've already got advice this morning about how you can join in by operating the hand function or waving to the camera or whatever. So we're about to start. As I said, it's very welcome to the Honourable David Coleman, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's well known to us, but I'll introduce him very briefly. He's got degrees in arts and law. He worked for quite some time in business and senior appointments in business. The Liberal Party member for Banks since 2013. He held ministerial positions in the Turnbull and Morrison coalition governments and is currently Assistant Minister to the Prime Minister for Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. And today, the Honourable David Coleman is going to address the Institute on suicide prevention, what can be done. Over to you, David Coleman.
Okay. Thank you, Jared. And thanks very much. And sorry about that technical issue, but good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. And before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we all meet and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. And it's great to be back with the Sydney Institute. As Jared mentioned, I've addressed the Institute before, and obviously there's nothing quite like meeting in person, but it's really important to maintain the discussion and the connection in any way we can. So thank you to the Institute for hosting me today. It is an incredibly important and historic time for public policy in Australia, and thank you to the Institute for helping me in drawing attention to the critical issue of suicide prevention. And it's particularly important as tomorrow is World Suicide Prevention Day. And in the past, the truth is that we haven't talked about this topic enough. And by the past, I mean over centuries. Our modern discussion of suicide is something that's really quite new. And the same goes for mental health generally. Simply talking about it is new. And I think that's a key point to start with, because that historic lack of discussion about suicide and mental health created a negative legacy that we're still dealing with, and we will be for some time. Because you can't address an issue properly if you aren't willing to talk about it. You know, nobody's ever been ashamed to admit that they have a cold or a sore tooth, but with suicide and mental health, silence or worse has been history's default position. There are still differences in the treatment of physical and mental illness. Stigma still exists, but things are getting better. Young people in particular feel much more comfortable talking about mental health than previous generations did. And it's now socially unacceptable to make light of mental illness, which is a fairly recent phenomenon. And we talk about suicide too. And in talking about it, we learn a lot. Why it happens, and how best to support people whose lives are at risk. But having said that, suicide is never easy to discuss. And in fact, it can be extremely hard to discuss, especially for those who have been personally affected by it. So I'd like to make an acknowledgement here at the beginning of my address that should the themes that I'm going to talk about bring on any level of distress, first of all, that's okay. It's a normal response. And second of all, if you do need help, please seek out that support. And that could be by calling Lifeline on 131114 or the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467, or simply by talking to someone you trust. Throughout the pandemic, my message to people has been a simple one. It's okay not to be okay. COVID has led to disruption to the lives of millions of Australians. And while lockdowns have been necessary, they're very damaging. Extended lockdowns grate against our deepest instincts. As humans, we weren't born to sit around. People feel isolated, kids miss their friends, relationships are under strain, and financial pressures are very real. And even when lockdowns aren't in place, COVID has cast a shadow over our communities. We've seen an increase in calls to Lifeline over this period. There's been an increase in paramedic call-outs to people experiencing suicidal thoughts, and an increase in Australians engaging in self-harm. And so people ask, what does this mean? And what can be done? While we have seen elevated levels of distress and suicidal crisis in the community during the pandemic, at this stage, there is no evidence of an overall increase in suicide. But we do see more people reaching out all the time. And that means a big part of our job is to ensure that when those people do come forward, the system that they're met with works. And I'll be going into a little of what that looks like later on. But I wanted to look back through our history to see what we can learn from understanding the rate of suicide over time. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare keeps data on suicide reaching back to 1907, primarily from coroner's reports. And that's a very substantial and important data set. And over that more than a century of data, to me, two key points stand out. In every single year since 1907, the rate of suicide has been higher among men than women. And the rate of suicide in 2019, the most recent year for which we have full published figures, was 12.9 suicides per 100,000 people. And that rate was actually slightly lower than the average rate across the entire century of data. Across the 114 years for which we do have data, the rate of suicide for men was roughly triple that of women. And in 2019, the rate of suicide for men was also roughly triple that of women. Women, however, account for the majority of the estimated 65,000 suicide attempts each year. Women are more likely to engage in self-harm and attempt suicide than men. The overall 2019 rate of suicide, as I mentioned, was lower than the century's average, but it was higher than in recent years. In 2006, the rate of suicide was 10.2 per 100,000 population. In 2019, it was 12.9. And while it's not straightforward at all to determine the reasons why the rate of suicide has changed over time, it's notable that the highest ever rate among men was recorded in 1930 at the height of the Great Depression. Another spike in suicide rates happened in the late 1980s and early 1990s, which again coincided with a period of high economic uncertainty. Now, we want to drive the suicide rate down towards zero. With the right public policy settings, we can absolutely save lives. We need to think about suicide prevention policy in the same way we've addressed other major policy interventions in the past. We know these interventions can work. In 1991, 25% of Australians smoked every day. Now it's less than 12%. Another example, and a shining light in focused public policy, is the decades-long effort to bring down the road toll. All states have made great efforts in this area, but as this is the Sydney Institute, let's talk about New South Wales. In 1970, 1,300 lives were lost on New South Wales roads. Half a century later, with a much larger population, 352 lives were lost in 2019. Governments have focused in relentlessly on the highest risk factors on the road, from seat belts to better road design, to random breath testing, to smarter speed limits, to public campaigns on the dangers of fatigue. All of these efforts have zeroed in on one goal, reducing the road toll. And it's worked. Building on this success, New South Wales is now seeking to reduce the road toll right down to zero. And we need to be just as focused in our efforts to reduce the rate of suicide to zero. The truth is that suicide is multifaceted and complex. And there's an almost infinite range of factors that can play a part in a person's decision to take their life. Establishing a direct causal link between specific factors and a suicide isn't always possible. Because the potential factors are so broad, it can be hard for policymakers to zero in on the best approach to take. The breadth of factors means that, in a sense, there is no wrong answer when it comes to addressing the rate of suicide. But this breadth of potential responses is in itself a risk because we need to focus to have an impact. As with other sustained policy efforts, such as in road safety and smoking, we need to identify the biggest risk factors and relentlessly focus on addressing them. And that's what we're doing. We're fortunate to have recent high quality reports on this most important issue from the Productivity Commission and the National Suicide Prevention Advisor last year, and the Victorian Royal Commission earlier this year, and from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, which maintains very deep and useful data. Again, it's important to note, suicide is complex, but there are some things we know for sure. We know that men are much more likely than women to take their life, and that this has been the case for more than a century. And we know that women have higher rates of ambulance attendances and hospitalizations for self-harm and suicide attempts. We also know that for both men and women, there are two factors that are most often present in situations where people take their lives. The most commonly identified risk factor for both females and males is a personal history of self-harm. The next highest risk factors for both females and males are relationship breakdown, including separation and divorce, and problems in relationships with a spouse or partner. And we also know that people in rural, regional, and remote Australia have a much higher suicide rate than people in metropolitan Australia. Australia is divided up into 31 primary health networks, or PHNs, which help to deliver local health services. Every single primary health network area outside of metropolitan Australia has a higher share of suicides than its share of population, every single one. Now, these issues must be at the absolute core of our efforts to reduce the rate of suicide. The high level of male suicide, something we know that has continued for more than a century, must be brought down. We must do a better job of reaching women in distress before a crisis leads to a suicide attempt. We must do everything we can to help people with a history of self-harm and people going through relationship distress. And we must respond to the specific issues facing rural and regional Australians to bring down the high rates of suicide that we consistently see outside of metropolitan centres. Of course, there are many other important issues that also need to be addressed. We need to ensure we place particular emphasis on helping groups who have higher rates of suicide than the population as a whole, such as our LGBTIQ community. We're already taking many steps to address these issues. As I said earlier, we haven't seen an overall increase in the rate of suicide since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. But we do know that sometimes traumatic events can bring a delayed effect. So we are very focused on this issue. Those pop-up clinics in Sydney opened just literally this week. Ever since the pandemic began, we've heeded the advice of experts like Christine Morgan, the Chief Executive of the National Mental Health Commission, and Dr. Ruth Vine, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for Mental Health, and delivered more than $500 million in direct mental health supports. In the budget, we allocated a record $2.3 billion to new initiatives in mental health, including a major investment in suicide prevention programs. As part of our $2.3 billion investment in the budget, we committed $159 million towards universal aftercare in Australia. Now, aftercare is about providing ongoing support in the community to people who have been discharged from hospital after a suicide attempt. The Productivity Commission, in the report that it provided to government, found that only about 50% of Australians who were discharged from hospital after a suicide attempt received follow-up care in the community. Now, it should be 100%. As we know that a history of self-harm is one of the highest risk factors for suicide. We want to work with the states to make aftercare universal. In addition, we've committed substantial funds to national suicide prevention activities. Soon, organisations will be able to apply for funding to run suicide prevention initiatives across the country. A total of $114 million will be available to support suicide prevention programs. We need to ensure that every dollar of this investment is targeted at where it will have the most impact. Through this program, we'll be looking for programs for opportunities to build and increase the capacity of communities to prevent and respond to suicide, and critically, to support targeted responses at the local level. We'll also be increasing suicide prevention programs in Indigenous communities. And in the budget, we announced a further $79 million in funding for this important priority. Indigenous Australians have tragically high rates of suicide, and this investment aims to drive down that rate. We also announced in the budget we will be creating a national suicide prevention office to drive suicide prevention activities across government. But there's more to do, a lot more to do. Our goal of reducing suicide towards zero is very ambitious. It will require great clarity of thought and precision in implementation. Under our federated system, both the Commonwealth and the states and territories have a very important role to play. One of the Commonwealth's key touch points is through our 31 primary health networks that I mentioned earlier, or PHNs. PHNs are designed to improve coordination of care, and they have a particular focus on mental health. We need to ensure that PHNs are focused every day on the biggest suicide risk factors in their community, and that they work every day to address those risks. The sharper and more efficient we are in targeting our efforts at the biggest risk areas, the more lives we can save. Now, over the past 4 years, the Commonwealth has overseen 12 suicide prevention trial sites with various programs run through our PHN networks. In each of these sites, we funded PHNs to deliver locally informed suicide prevention initiatives. Earlier this year, the Black Dog Institute published their assessment of the impact of these 12 trial sites. And what they found is that this approach has great potential to save lives. Not everything in the trials has been perfect, but there is much from which we can learn. With time and with sustained support from government, these kinds of interventions will save lives. We know that locally led, tailored solutions can work. And we need to engage all PHNs in this work and make sure that they have the tools that they need to drive down the suicide rate in their area. Part of that task is improving the access to real-time data for each PHN. PHNs should be aware of the level of suicide in their communities at all times, so that they can respond in real time to the needs of those communities. Today, that information is often not available until well after a suicide has occurred. We need to fix that. We are working more closely than ever before with the states and territories on suicide prevention policy. At present, we're working on a national agreement with the aim of aligning our strategies and pursuing a joint effort on this most critical of issues. It's the right thing to do because a more focused, integrated system will be a better system which saves more lives. There's a great deal of goodwill in these discussions, and I'm looking forward to continuing to work closely with the states and territories. Before I leave you, and in acknowledgement of World Suicide Prevention Day tomorrow, I want to pay tribute to Australia's mental health and suicide prevention workforce. It's not an easy job. It puts you in situations that can be very distressing. It can be emotionally draining. And it can be frustrating too, if you feel the system isn't working as well as it could be. But it's an incredibly important job. What could be more important than working every day to save lives? Historically, these roles have been underappreciated. Because society didn't talk much about mental health and suicide prevention, we didn't talk much about the heroic efforts of people who work in the field. But we should, and we will. So thank you to everyone who is working right now to help our fellow Australians in this most crucial of areas. We've discussed some difficult topics tonight, but they need to be discussed. We have much to do in this area and historical bias to overcome. But by doing the hard, focused, practical work that we need to do, I'm confident that we can drive the rate of suicide in Australia towards zero. Thank you all very much, and very happy to take your questions.
Many thanks to David Coleman for a very comprehensive analysis. So we come to questions and discussion. As I've mentioned, this period, as was the talk, is on the record, and I've asked you to use the hand signal to get in and nominate, and I'll give you a call. Can I just start off by asking you, Minister, you pointed out that the rate of suicide in Australia has not increased dramatically in recent years. But I think you're the first minister with the responsibility at the Commonwealth level for suicide prevention and mental, particularly for suicide prevention. So, and you've indicated the money that's been spent in the last budget on, or allocated in the last budget on this issue. So if the suicide rate hasn't increased dramatically in recent years, why did the coalition government see a need to move into this area, which is also an area, as you know, where the states and territories operate?
Yeah, well, Jared, while we haven't seen an increase in the rate of suicide during the pandemic, we have seen, and we've seen over a number of years, trends in relation to mental health more generally, where we've seen increasing signs of distress. And that's particularly been the case for young people. One of the positive things is that because the stigma around mental health is so much less than it was, and particularly for young people, more people are coming forward, particularly young people, and that's very positive. But at the same time, we are seeing an underlying increase in the levels of distress. So if you look at things like presentations to psychiatrists by children, up very substantially, the prescription of antidepressants to children, up very substantially, the use of systems of services across the board in mental health, in Medicare, you know, up substantially, particularly for young people. So whilst we haven't seen a significant increase in the rate of suicide, we have seen significant increases in the rates of utilisation of mental health services. And this is an issue that the government is very passionate about, and the Prime Minister is very passionate about in particular. So back in December, when I started this role, you know, the discussions we had were all about the need to, you know, do more in this area, to do as much as we can to help Australians struggling with mental health issues. And the government has done an enormous amount. Our funding in mental health has close to doubled over the past decade. So, you know, huge increase in resources, you know, $500 million of investment across the time of the pandemic. But I think we all recognize that historically the mental health system hasn't got as much attention as the broader health system, if you go back, you know, 20 plus years, for some of the reasons that I talked about, because we haven't focused on it as a society as much as we should have back then. And we want to address that. We want to build a better system. You're right that the states have a key role, and broadly the states are responsible obviously for the hospitals and the what's known as the more sort of severe and acute level of mental health, while the Commonwealth has a particularly big role in early intervention and prevention and what we call primary care, so you know, GPs and psychologists and so on. But there's a lot more we can do to cooperate with the states. There's a lot more where we can align our activities, because one of the frustrations in the system at the moment for people is there are gaps. People have to tell their story multiple times to different professionals. The system can be much better structured than it is today, and that does require a joint effort between the Commonwealth and the states, and that's what we're working on right now.
Thank you. So we go to the Institute's chair, Jacqueline Wilcox, and we go to Mark Patterson. Jacqueline.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister, for a very sensitive presentation tonight. And I wonder if there's a silver lining, if one can call it that, in the pandemic, because it seems to me that what these lockdowns have done is make people more aware of how isolated people can feel, and how everything can get too much. I must say I'm constantly being asked, and I'm also aware of asking my friends and colleagues, you know, how they are, and of course today being Are You Okay Day. Have you seen that a situation that we're all in collectively in this country has actually given a bit of hope about, one, discussing mental illness or just sadness or melancholia or whatever you want to call it, and then taking that leap to, you know, the bigger issue? Do you think that when...
I think it's undoubtedly the case that we as a society have talked much more about mental health issues since the onset of COVID than we had in the past. So that is a positive in the sense that we're talking more about it. I think also the unfortunate truth is that more people have experienced mental health issues and difficulties during the COVID period. And so it's logical that there would be more discussion of it in society and in the media and so on. So I think that is good, because the discussion, because as I said before, you know, you can't address a problem properly unless you're willing to talk about it. And, you know, I'm 47, and I say, look back when I was, you know, growing up in, you know, the 80s, and, you know, we didn't talk much about these issues at all as a society back then. And I think it's been a gradual improvement in that time. But I think it'd be fair to say more discussion in the past 2 years probably than any time before. And the government is, you know, it's very focused on addressing the issues that we've seen in the pandemic, but also more broadly in the mental health system.
Mark Patterson, then we go Anne Henderson. Mark.
Thanks, Jared. Minister, thanks for participating this afternoon. And it's great to see a positive advocate for dealing with mental health and dealing with suicide and all of the related issues that go with that. I'm struck that the states and territories that have responsibility for mental health are also the ones who are responsible for destroying people's lives and livelihoods at the moment by locking people down, crushing the economy as best they can to save life, but not lives. The mental health numbers that you referred to show an impact of suicides dramatically higher than the consequences of COVID. I'm interested, as the Mental Health Minister, whether you have an observation to make about the reactions of state and territory governments in response to COVID relative to the impact on individual lives lost as a result of suicide.
Yeah, well, I think the first point just to make is that, as I said in the speech, we haven't seen an increase in the rate of suicide during the COVID period, so it hasn't increased. What has increased, undoubtedly and very clearly is a level of distress in the community and use of services like Lifeline and Beyond Blue and so on. No question about that. And look, I think that lockdowns obviously have had a very significant impact on people and their mental health. They have been necessary as we've navigated through the pandemic, but you know, there's no sugarcoating the fact that they're extremely difficult, and they have resulted in many people going through difficult times. You know, kids want to be out playing with their friends. You know, they don't want to be at home. People in small business want to be out running their small businesses. People want to live their lives, and there's something very fundamental to what it means to be human, to be want to be out and about, and you know, pursuing whatever you want to pursue. And we haven't been able to do that under lockdown. So no question that it's had a significant impact. As I said, we haven't actually seen an increase in the rate of suicide.
I accept that, Minister, but the 12.9 per 100,000, that's 10 times the level of deaths that we're seeing as a result of COVID. And we've seen our borders closed, most of our freedoms taken away, and people's lives and livelihoods destroyed. We're seeing that in response to COVID, but not in relation to something that's 10 times more impactful in relation to loss of life.
Sorry, Jared.
Brief response, then we'll move on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, look, I'm not sure I quite agree with the way you've described the numbers there, but I think the broader point is that, you know, lockdowns have been necessary, and it's not the case that, so it's certainly not my view that it would have been possible for state governments not to put in place some lockdowns. It's also true that lockdowns are really hard, and it's also true that we need to get out of lockdown as soon as we sensibly can, because they do have a very significant impact on people. And so I was very encouraged by the announcements of the Premier in New South Wales today about the opening up of New South Wales as we reach that 70% figure, because it's very clear that lockdowns are not sustainable as a way of life, and they should be as short as possible.
Thanks, Mr.
Minister, and then we go to Dr. Ida Lecteran.
Minister, at my age, you look back and you realise you've encountered this problem of suicide in different formats. And I look back at the young people I knew in schools that took their lives, older people who are still fighting the thought they want to do away with their lives, being in that state for many decades. But the thing that really puzzles me in all of this is that are the cases where there is a suicide, but there is no obvious reason that that person wanted to kill themselves. There are places, there are people that you hear of where you say they're at the end, they can't live anymore, whatever, but that the young person who's got a very happy family life, who seems to have the world at their fingertips, and suddenly they commit suicide. What is there in the way of research about this, or any thought about this, or is there a point where we have to accept that there will never be an end to suicide? We'll always have suicide.
Well, look, our goal is zero suicides, and it's the right goal, because there's no other level that we should be willing to accept as a society. So that's what we're working towards. In terms of the question about factors and reasons why, as I said in the speech, you know, the truth is that it's not always possible to identify why a suicide has occurred. We do have the data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, which goes through and looks at the circumstances and the characteristics and factors that are present in cases of suicide. And I referred to some of those during the speech. And so things like a history of self-harm, things like relationship breakdown, divorce, and so on, are significant factors in many suicides. But you're right in saying that it's not always possible to identify before someone seeks to take their life that is going to occur. So the response has to be multifaceted. So it's about the mental health system itself. The stronger the mental health system is, the more support people will get within it. And it's also about reaching people who aren't in the mental health system, who haven't presented with specific issues. And that's things like more informal conversations. So things like, are you okay day to day? Encouraging those conversations, encouraging people to get help. It's about focused efforts in communities that we know are at particular risk, such as the Indigenous community and the LGBTIQ community. But the truth is, suicide is very complex and very multifaceted, and it requires efforts on many fronts. One of the reasons the PM created the role that I'm doing is that he recognised that whilst the health system is obviously a huge, huge part of our government response here, it's not the only part, because there are other elements of government, whether it's education or social services or other policy areas that are also relevant to this overall effort. And so I work with ministers across the government on these issues. But I think that the central point you're making about the fact that it can't always be understood, so to speak, or anticipated is correct. And that's why we've got to be so broad in our efforts.
Fred Chilton.
Thank you very much, Minister. Appreciated that. I had two quick questions. One, are you aware of whether there's been any work by technology development in the AI, use of AI to predict whether someone might be at risk and therefore intervention before they actually present? And secondly, I'm concerned about ADF veterans from Afghanistan war who, and Iraq for that matter, who not only many have suffered PTSD, but I know many are very distressed at the moment because of what happened with the handover to the Taliban and the quick fall of Kabul, very similar to what happened in Saigon in the 70s, and the failure of Australia to rescue the people that worked with them. And I just wonder whether some specific efforts are being made by Defence and your department to get in there and address these before worse happens.
Well, why don't I take the second part first in regarding Afghanistan and so on. And as you know, we were able to get a very large, very substantial number of people out of Afghanistan through the efforts in recent months. And in terms of the support that's available, so Veterans Affairs has a program called Open Arms, which has been running for some years. And it provides very specific support for veterans. The rate of suicide amongst veterans is higher than it is amongst the community as a whole. The issues that veterans go through and have experienced are very different to those non-veterans. I mean, the truth is, you know, I've never personally put my life at risk and put myself in that sort of environment in the same way that veterans have. You know, most of us haven't done that, but they have. And that, unfortunately and sadly, can lead to very significant mental health issues down the track. And so Open Arms is a big program. There's a large amount of resources available for veterans. We recognise that there's still more to do there. As you're probably aware, the government is doing the Royal Commission under Commissioner Nick Caldas. But there is absolutely a lot of resources. And I'd say as well, numerous advocates within the government. There are quite a few veterans amongst our ranks in Canberra, members of parliament, and they ensure that these issues are front and centre. And I've discussed these issues with them on numerous occasions, and we'll keep at it because it's a critical issue. In terms of the first question about the, scientific efforts in terms of neurophysics and so on, there is a lot of activity in that area. There are research taking place in Australia and around the world, some in the public sector, some in the private sector. And the thing that obviously people would like to get to is a situation where we can more clearly anticipate when a mental health issue is going to arise so we can get people help earlier. And there is a lot of scientific work going on that. And in that context, I should mention one of the big themes of the Productivity Commission report is about early intervention and prevention. So the more we can sensibly do to help people before a situation, a serious situation arises, right, the better. One of the things we committed to in the budget is more than $100 million for a new digital platform, which we're building at the moment under the Head to Health brand. And that's going to be a really important feature of our system. And in time, that will become a central place for people to go if they're starting to have worries or concerns about mental health, or even if they're just wanting to get information. It already exists today, the site, but we're building it out substantially, and that will be a really important feature of our system in the future.
Thank you very much.
Hi there.
Thank you very much, Minister. As you said, there are very complex factors involved in attempted and completed suicide. How do you involve psychiatrists and other mental health professionals in assessment of potential suicide within the vulnerable groups?
Well, they're involved extensively. I mean, one of the people that I talk to most frequently is Ruth Vine, Dr. Ruth Vine, who is the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, who is a psychiatrist with immense experience in this area. And Ruth is very central to all of our efforts. So, for instance, with the Head to Health program, which we announced in the budget, $500 million to roll out a new network of adult mental health centres, which will be a very substantial feature of our mental health landscape in the future. Ruth has been very intimately involved in determining the model of care, ensuring that there's the right access to psychiatry, psychology, and all the other professions. Because one of the things that the sector has been advocating for some time is what we call multidisciplinary care. So the person goes to one place and is seen by a team of people who are all there to help them, and they don't have to go from A to B to C to D and retell their story and so on. And what we've done with the Head to Health centres in the budget is say, we agree. The government agrees with that approach. We think multidisciplinary teams are absolutely the right structure. And psychiatry is a big part of that, as it is in basically all the activities we do in this area.
Okay, we go to Dennis O'Day. Dennis?
Good afternoon, Minister. Thank you very much. I was very interested in your statistics that you gave in terms of the rates since 1906 and the two peaks in 1930 and the 1980 and the three times for men. What work has been done around younger men in terms of suicide, the 15 to 25-year-old group? And you mentioned some of the key things were relationships falling apart. And my thought was anything that may have been done by the Institute of Family Studies and the link between, say, fatherless households, families falling apart and family dysfunction, and how do we keep families together as a mitigator against people attempting suicide or completing suicide?
Yeah, no, it's an important issue. And one of the other things we did in the budget was allocate funding for, through the family relationship centres, for support for people who are going through mental health issues, and often in the context of legal actions and disputes and family breakups and so on, because unfortunately it is the case that often a breakup can be present at the same time as mental health issues. In terms of young men and young women for that matter, we have seen for quite a number of years now a significant increase in that level of distress. And there are various bodies of work as to why that's occurring. There are some views that it's in relation to a less hope for the future. There are some people who put forward that argument in relation to family structure. There's obviously the whole impact of digital and the way that unfiltered information that kids have access to that they didn't have access to in previous generations. But we continue to work on that issue, continue to fund Headspace, which is our big national network of support centres for young people, about $300 million in the budget additional for Headspace. And as I said, it's about going forward on a whole range of fronts. Digital is important too, because we know that that's where young people are, and the Head to Health digital platform that we're developing will also be an important part of our response for those younger males and females.
I just had this, but I'm surprised. I've got a very large family of young kids, and it just seems endemic among the kids. It's not great.
Look, there's no question that the rate of mental health issues amongst kids has increased significantly in recent years. And part of that is an underlying increase in the prevalence of conditions. Part of it, in terms of the statistics, is a greater willingness to come forward, which is actually a positive thing, that you know, kids are more comfortable coming forward. They don't have the stigma associated with these issues of the previous generations. But if you look at things like emergency department presentations for mental health related issues for young people, there have been significant increases. The rate of increase is clearly higher than the rate of increase amongst the population as a whole. And that's why it's so important that we respond very specifically to the needs of kids and young people. We have a program that we fund through Beyond Blue in schools called BU, which is a quite deep and sophisticated set of resources for teachers, principals, and so on to make use of, so that they can help kids who are going through difficult times and through Headspace. We obviously work with schools as well, but there's more to do, because this issue of youth mental health is a major issue. It's something government's concerned about. It's something the Prime Minister is very focused on, and we continue to work on that, and that will be an ongoing priority for us.
We're going to finish no later than the top of the hour, so if you haven't let me know you're coming in, let me know. So I think, Jay, are you back now?
Yes, thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, Minister, for being here. My concern is about what I guess I'm going to call suicide failures. I'm a minister of religion by trade, and I often had to deal with people at the bedside and sadly in the families of people who have attempted suicide, failed. But I want to know what ongoing support and help and understanding and nurture there is for those people. And then there's the other group of people who are the families of people who have, I hate to even use this word, have been effective in killing themselves. They're just left high and dry, and many of them with very little understanding, insight or knowledge as to why they have been left in such a terrible space. What's happening to these people?
Yeah, so let me address each of those. So firstly, about the care for people who have attempted suicide, I think you're right in saying that more care needs to be provided to people who are in that group. And at the moment, the Productivity Commission found that about half of people who are discharged from hospital after a suicide attempt get ongoing care in the community. Now, we don't accept that. We don't accept that we acknowledge the fact of that, but we don't think that that should be the case. We think it should be 100%. It needs to be 100%. We put $159 million into this in the budget. And to Jared's point about the role of the states, we want to work with the states to ensure that we can make that happen and work side by side with them. So that's for people who are discharged from hospital. There are other people, of course, many people who, sadly, who attempt to commit suicide but who are not hospitalised. And we've also provided funding in the budget to better reach those people. But I agree with you. I think this is an area where much more needs to be done, and we made some very specific commitments on that in the budget. The issue of families who are bereaved by suicide is also a very important one. It's sometimes called postvention. And we already fund a substantial amount of this activity through an organisation called Standby in Queensland, who do terrific work through that program. And in the budget, again, we want to increase the focus on postvention, because we want postvention to be available to all people who are going through that very tragic and sad situation. And again, it's an area where we think there's an opportunity for cooperation with the states, because we need to do everything we can to help people who are going through that most tragic of circumstances.
Charles, are you there?
No? We're getting close to the end. Have I missed anyone? Can I just ask you to reflect on a more general issue? When I was in primary school, a boy who I didn't know very well, he was slightly older than me, committed suicide. No one spoke about it. As I went through life, I know suicides that occurred and people didn't mention them because insurance was involved. In those days, insurance often didn't cover suicides. And even in recent years, the media didn't report many suicides. There was kind of prohibition on it for good reasons, but there was a prohibition on it. Is the fact that we talk much more about suicide now and acknowledge it, I mean, do you regard that as beneficial, or was it better in days gone by when people didn't discuss it so much?
No, I think it is important to discuss it. It's also important that we are sensitive and discuss it in the right way. There are guidelines for the media in the best ways of, or the most appropriate ways of discussing suicide, and they're really important. There are certain things that it's better not to discuss publicly. And to their credit, the Australian media, I think, generally does a very good job of sticking to those guidelines. On the more general question of whether we should talk about it, I think with that important caveat in terms of the nature of what we, how we talk about it, I think we should, and I think it's important, because in order to address an issue, you have to acknowledge it, and you have to marshal the resources of the society to help address it. Because not just government, there are things that we can all do in terms of having those conversations, ensuring that we ensure that society continues to reduce to zero that level of stigma that has historically been there. So I think it's actually entirely appropriate to discuss suicide. It's a very difficult topic. And the truth is that, you know, 20 years ago, we probably wouldn't have had this discussion that we've had today. But I think it's really good that we are. I think that society as a whole recognises the importance of the issue. The government is determined to do everything we can to drive this rate down to zero. And I think our more recent willingness as a society to talk about these issues is really positive, because we know in the past that when they weren't talked about, you know, certainly that wasn't, you know, as effective as it could have been in terms of addressing the substance of the issue. So I think we should talk about it, but always be cognizant of how we do it.
Pretty well close to the top of the hour, so I think it's a very good time to end. It's a very good comment on which to end. So I'd just like to say to the Minister, thanks to you and your office for asking the Sydney Institute to sponsor this speech tonight, which we're delighted to do on an important topic on an important day of the year. You've been, you're very much a Minister who's quite on top of your brief. I mean, there's nothing you haven't answered or responded to. It's been a very active time for the Morrison government in this area, and best wishes for the future. But for tonight, thank you and well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you to everyone who's been on the call. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.